What's up, guys? I'm Meg, and this is the Millennial Rewatcher. In my brain, it still tries to come out as We Watcher instead of Rewatcher. So I don't know if I just sounded like that, but perhaps. Welcome back, my dudes, my lovelies, my listeners,
whoever's out there.
Sorry, this episode is coming out a bit late. I honestly feel like shit about it because I already do episodes every other week. So to get an episode out late when I already don't do weekly episodes, I feel super guilty about that. But I'm also just going to be honest about it. I have lupus. I'm in the process of getting my official diagnosis of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a connective tissue disorder, excuse me, between a ton of other things, including horrible anxiety, and just, I could keep going. I got behind. I physically was in too much pain and under too much brain fog, mental duress to be able to function to get this out on time. I just would prefer to be honest about it because, look, I don't think any of us, I mean, it's always up to the person to disclose what they're going through, but I don't think hiding chronic illness helps anyone, including yourself, if you're someone who struggles with chronic illness. Of course, if staying on the down low about your chronic illness is what is best for you, then do what's best for you. For me, not being able to talk about it makes it worse. And I think that more often than not, people who are chronically ill are dismissed as attention-seeking crazy. And it further creates harmful stigma. And I kind of hate that. We should be able to talk about these things in any setting. And you know what? It's a part of my everyday life. So if it seeps into my podcast about recapping movies that I have trauma bonds to, not always, but most of the time, then here we are. Fuck it. If me sharing it helps one person, then I will be ecstatic for the rest of my life. I'm not exaggerating. It quite literally affects my everyday life. I will continue to do my best to get episodes out on time. I already feel like an epic failure for not getting this out on time. This is something that's really important to me. So anyways, I'm going to stop talking about that now so we can get into the movie. I think part of the reason I was also struggling with making sure I was staying on track was because I was struggling with what movie to do next. I had originally decided to do Drop Dead Gorgeous, which I am still going to do, but it's a bigger conversation because, as embarrassed as I am to admit it, I completely missed the satire in that movie. And every single frame, every single character has an element of satire that's, a lot of it is really in your face, and I still missed it, and I feel stupid for that. So I will be doing Drop Dead Gorgeous at some point in time. But you know what? Today we're doing What Lies Beneath. This movie came out in 2000. I had not watched this movie in a very long time, and I couldn't even remember the title, but I knew that Michelle Pfeiffer was in it, so it was easy to find once I decided to go a-searching. It's definitely a very Hitchcockian-like, it's a weird word, thriller. Harrison Ford is in it. It didn't receive the best reviews from critics, but I don't really care to read too many reviews, whether it be from a popular critic or an everyday reviewer, because I want to form my own opinion. You know, I am curious to see how other people feel about it and their perception because a lot of times I do miss things that might be obvious to other people. And especially if it's a movie I feel very passionately about, I might want to seek out what other people have to say, but not before I watch it, typically. I like to form my own opinion. That's part of the experience, you know? But it was really fun to revisit this movie. I wouldn't necessarily say with majority of my episodes thus far that I have a huge trauma bond to it. I felt a little bit of a certain type of way rewatching it just because it is something that I really enjoyed when I was a kid, and revisiting anything that originated for me as a kid can be an experience sometimes. I mean, regardless, thinking about me watching this movie as a kid and just that environment and the time and stuff, it's bound to bring some shit up. But this one really didn't heavily do that for me at all. I am definitely a film noir fan, a Hitchcock fan, more so his movies, not so much the guy. I think I might have mentioned something about that before. Someday I would love to do maybe a little mini series on Hitchcock, but also talk about him himself. Sometimes unmasking the people we revere at a high capacity can be very healthy. even though it can also be really unnerving and kind of affect the way we feel about certain things. So it would be interesting to visit someday, though. There's elements of What Lies Beneath that definitely feel very Rear Window, Vertigo, Psycho at points. I found an article that kind of made some better connections than I could make for you to Hitchcock films, and that will be linked in the show notes for you if you're interested. But a lot of it has to do with the choice of camera angles, honestly, which sounds kind of uninteresting offhand, but when you watch it visually, it is a treat. I'll try to explain that a little bit more when we get to those certain parts. What Lies Beneath, it is a thriller, a psychological thriller, starring Michelle Pfeiffer as Claire Spencer, who's kind of our main character, and Harrison Ford, who plays her husband, Dr. Norman Spencer. He's a college professor and research scientist, I believe. I just specifically looked that up because I'm sure that might be easy to surmise from the movie, but I like to have the specific correct terms because I was just calling him like research doctor dude, for example. They live in a sort of academic community. He works in a more academic college setting. And I just was like, wait, what is this official title? I don't know. Let's look it up. Let's get into it. Again, What Lies Beneath, psychological thriller. It's about a woman, Claire Spencer, whose daughter has just gone off to college. She is a retired musician. She stopped playing the cello. She was a classically trained musician. She stopped playing the cello when she got married to her second husband, Dr. Norman Spencer. When her daughter goes off to college, it's also a year after a pretty bad car accident that she had gotten into. She was the one driving, the only one in the car. And shortly after her daughter leaves, her house seems to start showing signs of being haunted. And she also develops a smidge or a big smidge of a fixation on her new neighbors, who are also a part of this academic community they live in. It takes place in Vermont. It's a really picturesque setting to me that I do devour with great pleasure. It's early fall. I've never been to Vermont. I'm not sure how quickly their weather patterns change, but it reminds me a bit of Washington as far as the foliage and that change in seasons being fairly distinct. For us here in Washington, all the kids go back to school early September. That's when kind of it feels like summer ends, even though it doesn't officially end till later in September. So, but the month of September will still stay pretty warm. And in this movie, I'm kind of guessing that it's end of August, early September, because her daughter is going off to college. I mean, I know college is different as far as start times, so I'm kind of throwing a guess, but you do get this great view throughout the movie of the season starting to change, and it's Vermont, so you know there's tons of trees and all these beautiful sprays of colors as the leaves change. There's a couple rainstorms in the movie, lots of fog. They live on a lake. We learn early on in the film that Claire and Norman, the house that they're living in, is a house that they just renovated. Norman's dad had owned it. It's right on a lake, Lake Champlain. Champlain. I'm so sorry. I forgot to look that up. And if I look it up now, I'm going to derail my brain too much. And I don't want to do that. I feel like I'm on a good roll. So I do apologize. Again, dyslexia. I just have a hard time pronouncing things. But I do try. Anyway, so it's supposed to take place in Vermont, Lake Champlain. I feel like I'm just saying it wrong and it's bothering me. So anyways, but they've newly renovated this house. The house was actually built for the film. So there's the Norman's house, the Spencer house, and then right next to them, I mean, they still have a pretty decent amount of yard and such between the homes. There's another house that was also built for the movie, and this is their neighbors, the Fuhrers, who have just moved in. Claire, she starts to develop, I mean, within the first scene of this movie, an interest in them. She starts to develop this habit of being suspicious of them and spying on them. I want to do this movie eventually, but I want to do it with my best friend, because it's kind of a movie that we enjoy watching together a lot. The Burbs, Tom Hanks is in it, Corey Feldman, there's other names and I'm forgetting. Princess Leia is in it. I'm so sorry, I'm just calling her Princess Leia. I feel rude, especially because I know she passed away somewhat recently, but I'm forgetting the actress's name, but she plays Tom Hanks' wife. life in it. Anyways, it's all about spying on your neighbors in suburbia and backyard secrets. It's a comedy as well as a scary movie, kind of, but to me, just more comedic. But I remember I would watch this movie a lot as a kid, and then I would try to come up with these elaborate plans to spy on the neighbors, and I would take notes on each house and how they looked and draw these like dorky maps that really just were like random squares and like house one. And I don't know, there's just something about it that was fun, and I wasn't breaking into anyone's backyards or, I don't know, doing anything nefarious. I just felt like I was acting like some sort of comedic detective that was going to be all up on the neighborhood scoop. And anyways, Claire doing that just kind of reminds me of me doing that as a kid, and I find it endearing. But let's get into our cast and a little bit of facts about the film real quick. So I already said it, but this movie was released in the year 2000. They filmed in 1999. It was directed by Robert Zemeckis, adapted from a screenplay written by Clark Gregg, based on a story by Sarah Kernochen and Clark Gregg. I'm so sorry if I just pronounced that last name wrong. Kernochen. Oof, I'm the worst. It was the first film released by Zemeckis's production company, Image Movers, and the original film was composed by Alan Silvestri. Before I forget, I just want to say the score, the music for this movie absolutely helps give it an eerie presence right from the start, and I love when it's scored perfectly to me. The music can make or break what emotion the film wants to drag out of you. And this one definitely does a good job the first opening scene, the music, there's already some sort of like eerie lingering presence there because of how it's scored. I feel like I do talk about that a little bit, the scoring, or I mention it here or there when it stands out to me, and I want to do a better job of crediting the people who are responsible for that. So I'm going to try to be making sure I'm doing that from here on out. So again, we have Michelle Pfeiffer as Claire Spencer, Harrison Ford as Dr. Norman Spencer. And from what I was saying, this is Harrison Ford's only thriller film that he's done, I believe. Diana Skarwid plays Jody, Claire's best friend. Miranda Otto plays Mary Fuhrer, the Spencer's neighbor. James Remar plays Warren Fuhrer, Mary's husband, and again, their neighbor. Catherine Town plays Caitlin Spencer, Claire's daughter and Norman's stepdaughter. Joe Morton plays Dr. Drayton, who is a therapist that Claire will see in the movie. Amber Valletta plays Madison Elizabeth Frank, who is a missing woman in the movie. And I don't want to give too much away around that, so that's all I'm going to say about her character right now. Both of the houses in this movie were built for the movie, but then they were torn down after filming was done. I believe, as the director of photography or the location manager, someone working on the film did utilize some of the pieces of the house to build their own home. If you watch this movie, or at least look it up, I'll have to post some photos of at least the exterior of the house. It's so fucking cool. I love this house. When it was being built for the film, they really wanted it to make it seem super enchanting and just, you know, this Vermont brilliance of an older stately home that's been renovated, but something that also, again, feels like there's an eerie lingering feeling about it that you can't quite shake. To me, they definitely accomplished that. It would have been cool if the house was still there to go visit, but I mean, I don't know. It has been turned into like a little park, and there's some sort of pavilion there now, but it's not the same, you know? So they built the houses, but then they also built sound stages back in Los Angeles, so replicas of the house. And I guess the bathroom, it's a master bathroom, but so it connects to the master. I think that's the wrong way to say that now. What do people call that now? There's another term for it that I've heard people use instead of master bedroom. And now I'm forgetting what it is. I don't know. There's another term for it now. But anyways, I'm sorry. I'm just going to keep saying that because I literally can't think of what the correct verbiage is now for that. But the bathroom connects to the master bedroom and then into the hallway as well. But I guess this bathroom, they built 5 different replicas of it. And they did so much filming in this bathroom that they needed these extra sets and such. And there was even times where filming was happening at both locations at the same time to get the shots and such that they needed. There's so much bathroom time. So much happening in this bathroom. There's this great line from an interview where Michelle Pfeiffer was saying that it was hard not to laugh sometimes because she could hear the crew in the bathroom kind of noisily filling up the bathtub and setting things up for her to walk in and be scared by, but she had to pretend not to notice. I will say that Michelle Pfeiffer in this film, to me, she does a brilliant job of almost being like a damsel in distress type character who doesn't want to be that way, but is treated that way. But then she can also be horribly creepy. Like, she landed the creepy part really well. Handy P. All right, guys, let's jump into this movie. I didn't have too many movie facts for you this time. If you're interested in trying to read a little bit more about the film and what the director had to say and the actors, just pop over to the show notes and you'll find some links to take you to that kind of stuff. Let's jump into the actual movie.
Are you ready?
What lies beneath Harrison Ford, Michelle Pfeiffer. Sorry, I had to. I know it's Pfeiffer, but I'll stop now. Okay, this movie opens up with Claire in the bathtub. Like I was just saying, we are going to get a lot of scenes in this bathroom. The tub is super involved. Might as well be another character because a lot of things happen here. I love the way this movie opens up, though, because as the opening credits are playing and, you know, the film's being introduced, blah, blah, blah. Claire, she comes flying up out of the water, but it's very creepy and eerie because it had just looked like a bloated dead body. And then her face comes flying out of the water and she's just panting for breath like she's been held underwater for a while. And it's very telling. We'll get to that. She also does something in this opening scene that I had never seen anyone else do before in my life. So it stands out in my brain to this day. And I haven't seen anyone do this since, but the mirror's all fogged up with condensation, right? I usually just leave it that way and the fans will, you know, take care of it. Or if I really need the mirror immediately, I'll wipe it down with a towel. I know it leaves streaks, but I don't give a fuck. I need to see my face or my hair or whatever, for whatever fucking reason. But she takes a hairdryer and dries the mirror with it. And I know it seems like a very innocuous kind of weird thing to point out, but I had just literally never seen anyone do that before. And it's just so slow and methodical and you're kind of waiting for something to happen. And she gets zapped, like there's a little electrical current that happens, but that's it. It's the morning that they are going to take Caitlin off to college. Claire is all up in her feelings. That makes sense. I haven't experienced that yet myself, but I'm sure it will be emotional. It's her only child as well, so that's significant. She goes and wakes Caitlin up. They kind of have this cute little interaction. And then on her way down to the kitchen, she's going to make Caitlin waffles, I think. Blueberry waffles. I have pancakes in my notes, but I think it's waffles. Norman comes up behind her as she was passing a window and the neighbors caught her attention because they were fighting passionately in the driveway, I believe. And she's kind of spying, but I mean, I would stop to watch as well. You know, I'm just going to say it. I'm going to be honest. I might stop and be like, what's happening? Especially because they're new neighbors. They're curious. Anyways, our first meeting of Norman is him trying to get in her pants and him, from my perception, being annoyed that Claire doesn't want to go get it on because Caitlin is like waking up and getting ready in the other room. And that's a personal choice. Okay. If she's not comfortable with that, that's fine. Sex is normal. Don't be ashamed to have sex. But if that's also something you're comfortable with, but he gets so visibly annoyed and he goes, how soon is she leaving? She's literally leaving that day. And he's trying to almost kind of pressure her a little bit into getting it on, even though she's saying no. I have to say, I'm going to get this over with now. From the get-go, there's just something about the character of Norman Spencer that immediately makes me feel uncomfortable and untrustworthy of him. And I know that's his character and I know it's intentional. And honestly, I think he does play this role very well. It puts me off almost immediately. And then I think I'm doing the thing where I start to take it personal as if his character has some sort of personal offense on my life. And you know, obviously that's not the case. I don't like him. Well, I'm not a huge fan of his other films like Indiana Jones, for example. I haven't seen all of the Indiana Jones movies, but I have seen them and I do remember watching them when I was younger. Harrison Ford wasn't someone who was significant in my brain. This movie definitely put me off of Harrison Ford because of this character, which I know is not fair. I get as I'm saying that, that's not fair. There's just something from here on out after seeing this movie with Harrison Ford that I'm like, I don't, like, there's something about him that bothers me. And I'm pretty sure I'm absorbing this character into the person himself. It's not like I actually fucking know this person, but it definitely affects how I speak about him in this movie. I just kind of want to let you all know that now. I'm gonna do my best not to sound like a major asshole when it comes to talking about his character, but also his character is a major asshole, okay? You're questioning him so much of the film. Is he more nefarious than he is, than, you know, want to believe? The answer is yes. He's nefarious as fuck. Okay. I don't know why I just snorted along with that, but I did. Anyways, he gets huffy, goes off for his run. They take Caitlin to college. It's seemingly uneventful. Claire definitely has a hard time letting go of Caitlin in the dorm room. And then when they are leaving and walking out through the hallway, she kind of almost reprimands herself by trying to laugh it off. Like, well, I almost made it. And, you know, she was just crying heavily, but not in a loud, distressed way. She wasn't being dramatic, but it's almost like she's chastising herself for having those emotions. And then while she's doing so, it's almost like Norman approves of her being like, yeah, I should just shut up. It's just really off-putting. Later that day, Norman's in bed with his big clunky 2000s laptop doing some work because, again, he's a research scientist, a doctor of some sorts. He's an academic fellow person, I don't know. And he's working on some big research paper, and he's been working even more because of this thing, blah, blah, blah. And I feel kind of stupid for this, but Claire's trying to get his attention, right? And she climbs into bed, and there's this big giant textbook with post-its sticking out from places that have been earmarked, and she picks it up and kind of pretends like she's reading it, and he goes, what you reading? And she makes some sort of joke. But I legitimately thought that this was her book. And guys, this book is huge. It's obviously some sort of giant textbook something. Not light reading. It's huge. When it took me a little bit to realize, oh, that's his, which makes so much more sense, and she's just doing that to try to get his attention, I felt so dumb. Anyways, she's trying to get it on. Anytime there's a scene in a show or a movie where there is more than a second of kissing, I would typically fast forward through it because I cannot stand the sound. There's also something about seeing Harrison Ford kissing and like really trying to like get at it with someone that just gives me the icks. Like the major icks. But you know what I was also realizing as I was watching this movie? I think why it gives me the icks is because he kind of reminds me of my now ex-stepdad. I don't know how to say that properly. Like, he used to be my stepdad. I don't want to think about him in that way. You know, like, do you get what I'm trying to say? Hopefully. I feel like I sound fucking ridiculous. But yeah, it just gives me the major icks. And I just, they're about to fook when they hear their neighbors loud fooking. Claire goes to crank the window shut and Norman says, think we can take him? It's the next day and Claire, she's in Caitlin's room. I can't even tell if she was just cleaning, organizing, putting things away. Whatever she's doing, she opens the top drawer to Caitlin's dresser and pulls out an old tank top. It has Juilliard written on it. I'm pretty sure Claire went to Juilliard and it's an old tank top of hers. And Claire just starts sniffing it. She takes a big old whiff of the laundry. Side note, real quick, Caitlin has an E.T. statue on her dresser. Just kind of loved seeing that little in it. I don't know. I enjoyed it. I would have taken E.T. with me to my dorm. Maybe she didn't love him that much. But it's the cutest little E.T. statue and he's so adorable. E.T. says, phone home, Caitlin. Mama Claire's about to be haunted as fuck by stepdaddy's behavior. The repercussions of his behavior. And I think I might be giving a little bit away too much by saying that, so we're going to move on. Claire's memory sniffing prompts her to go get out an old photo album. And she comes across a Polaroid of her wrecked car that just is labeled insurance claim on the bottom. And it's from a year ago, from the car accident she was in a year ago. So Claire is starting to really have some big emotions. And at the same time as she's looking, she finds this photo. She's looking at older photos of herself in the Juilliard shirt, Caitlin as a baby, Claire in her musician days. Her cello is in its case behind her. It kind of seems like she hasn't even played in a really long time. And it just emotes some really big emotions. So she ends up, you know, kind of tossing the album to the side and she runs outside to get some air. She's really into her garden. She has this giant rose garden. It is lovely. Lots of roses. I would have an asthma attack, but there's lots of pretty roses. She runs out into her garden and she's kind of crying to herself on a bench when she overhears an even bigger crying on the other side of the fence from the Fuhrers. And it's her loud fooking neighbor, Mary Fuhrer, who also is Harry Potter's mom. Yes, she plays Harry Potter's mom. Lily Potter. Now I'm questioning that, but I'm pretty sure that's correct. Anyways, Mary's having some of her own super big emotions. So Claire goes over to the fence and she's asking her, are you okay? Can I help you with anything? Mary, she says these random things regarding her emotions that don't really make sense. They've been there for a few weeks now.
Mrs. Fuhrer? Hello? Are you all right? Oh, he's so... It's too much. I can't... What are you afraid of? Something I can do? Can I?
I've never even met you.
No, I'm sorry. I've been consumed.
Eventually, Mary hears her husband's car coming up the drive, and she was like, oh my God, I don't want him to see me like this. And she runs inside. Claire had kind of been up against the fence trying to peek through, and I was this whole time, I'm like, girl, just go around the fence. Like, it's a significant amount of fence between your yards, but like, you could, it's a quick jaunt over to the other end. Just like, pop your head around. Because she's climbing through all of her roses, and she keeps getting caught on these damn roses. Anyways, later that night, Claire is trying to tell Norman about this interaction at dinner, and Norman, the character is set up to get on my fucking nerves from the get-go, because he is very, very dismissive. He's acting like Claire doesn't understand the interaction she had with Mary, as if he was fucking there. I feel like he's very, very manipulative in his words, but almost like covert manipulation. Eventually, he does say, you know what, I'll ask someone he works with at the college, Stan, I think his name is, if he knows anything about the Fuhrers. And then that kind of placates Claire enough to be like, okay, cool. The next day, Claire goes over to the neighbors. She's got a welcome basket. She's definitely snooping a little bit. She finds a sandal, you know, seemingly Mary's sandal, around the corner of this kind of L-shaped front porch with a pretty significant blood drop on it. And she picks it up. She seems alarmed by it. And then she sets it back down on the handrail instead of where it was on the porch. And then she leaves. She doesn't leave the basket there. And she goes back to her house. And her friend Jody is there on the front porch for her, waiting for her. Jody's there to just check up on her. Claire's kind of like, why is everyone treating me like I'm so fragile? Because Jody's like, well, you know, you've been through a lot. And then Caitlin just went to college. And Claire's like, I can handle it, you guys. You don't need to treat me like I'm this delicate thing that can't handle herself. And truly, I really feel like when people are treated like they are porcelain and will crack at any second, I kind of feel like that is invalidating to their autonomy as a person, but it also doesn't really help the situation. It kind of reinforces the idea that they are, and then it's harder to act accordingly to the things that are actually better for you. So we start to get some of the spooky, ooky, ghosty stuff happening in the house. Like, later that night, after Jody pops by for a surprise visit, they have this older, like, bulky computer. Well, it's older for us, but it's not old for the movie. But, you know, it's one of those clunky, bulky desktop computers. The origin era of desktops. It's just so fucking nostalgic. I can't even stand it. I love it so much. Even more nostalgic is she's playing solitaire on it. And I used to love to play solitaire on the computer. I would get so good at it sometimes. Claire's playing solitaire when the power goes out. Power's all like, nah, don't feel like powering up right now. Okay, bye. She starts to go around the house to shut some windows, specifically in her bedroom. It's raining. It's super stormy. It's dark as shit outside now. I mean, it already was. There's lightning. She's trying to crank her bedroom window shut, and that's when she sees in her neighbor's driveway a flash of light that illuminates Warren Fuhrer putting what looks like a duffel bag stuffed with a body in the trunk of his car. So she tries to wake Norman up, who is like dead asleep, and when he does wake up, he pops out of bed. He's like, ah!
Norman! Norman! Come here! You have to see this! I thought I saw
Oh,
something.
Jesus Christ!
Because he's startled by being woken up, and it is kind of funny. By the time he gets to the window, there's nothing to be seen, and he's annoyed, and he's just like, go to bed, Claire. He's such a grumpy fucking bear. The next day, Claire starts to kind of do some more investigating at the Vera's house. She's peeking around. She's trying to peek over the fence. Again, girl, like, just poke your blonde ass head around the end of the fence. It's not that far. And then you would stop cutting yourself on the goddamn roses. Okay. But she don't do that. So she cuts her arm again on the goddamn roses. And then she goes to go back into the house and the door opens on its own. And this is going to be a reoccurring thing with this door. This door likes to open on its own. She goes inside. She makes a big show of, you know, trying to make sure the door is shut. And then something just kind of gets her attention right off the bat. And there's just another window open. So maybe it was just the breeze. But she goes into what's Norman's office and shuts the window. And as she is looking around, she accidentally knocks over a photo frame. And it's a framed newspaper clipping from a year ago when Norman had won some sort of prestigious award for his research in genetics and academics or something. The DuPont chair in genetics is what it's called. DuPont. And when she comes back to the foyer, the front door is open again. It's later that night. Claire's down on the dock to their house. She looks a little haunted. She looks forlorn. She looks lonely. She's trying to play with the dog, throwing his ball into the lake. Their dog, Cooper, he's a long-haired furry dog. At first, I thought he was a golden retriever. And then I remembered, oh, he doesn't really have the coloring for a golden retriever. So I'm not sure what kind of dog this is, but he's so cute and floofy. I love him. And he does not want to get into the lake. And she's like, Cooper, it's your favorite ball. Cooper won't get into the lake as she is trying to retrieve this ball on her own because Cooper's like, nah, bitch. A ghosty, waterlogged face kind of floats up from the water and she's like, what's this? But as fast as it appears, it goes back down. She's just like, what is happening to me? The door, the frame knocking over. Now this, it's strange. The phone rings. She has a handheld cordless phone with her and it rings. It startles the shit out of Claire and Cooper. So Cooper goes running off.
Hello?
And Cooper's actually going to be gone for a little bit. It seems like it takes a couple days for this dog to come back. Maybe not a couple days, but it seems like a couple days to me. And the whole time I'm like, what? Why are we not more concerned about where the dog is?
The feck?
Cooper's run off. It's super foggy. It's a dark, eerie night
on the lake.
She's kind of half-heartedly calling for Cooper from their front porch. And when he doesn't come, she's like, fine, have it your way. And she goes back inside. The door opens on its own again. She definitely looks scared. And then the stereo kind of right off in one of the rooms from the foyer of this entryway of the house. It turns on for a few seconds, super fucking loud, all static. And then it turns off just as fast. There's a shot of her and she decides to head to Norman's work. And this is a quick scene, but it is important because as she's walking in, we overhear other people, what seems to be his research team, talking about this drug and medical research that they've been doing. This drug essentially is a type of anesthesia, a sort of intentional paralytic. I'm not using the right words for that. But anyways, it leaves the person who's under the influence of this drug completely paralyzed and but also pain-free at the same time, but also they're still cognizant and fully aware of what's happening to them. And of course, just like an anesthesia, depending on how much you give to them, it will wear off. So as she's passing by some of the researchers, they're explaining that like this little drop will last for 2-3 minutes.
Halothane? Is that a sedative?
It's a dissociative agent. It paralyzes motor functions but leaves her conscious. She can't move but knows what's going on.
That is important to remember. So this framed newspaper clipping of him winning this DuPont chair thing, it's going to keep popping back up. It keeps falling off the shelf that it's on. And at one point it falls and the glass completely shatters. As she's fixing it, something in the vent on the floor in the room she's in kind of catches her eye. And she pulls out this sort of like odd little key that was stuck in the vent and she pockets it. But as she is then going upstairs, she starts to see steam coming out from under the door of this bathroom. She goes in and this tub is completely full of water. She goes to pull the drain stopper. At the same time, she sees the dead, ghosty, waterlogged body face right next to her in the water, in the water's reflection. It scares the absolute shit out of her. So Claire's going to start going to a therapist. And this therapist office is definitely one of those partially underground locations that the windows, they're higher up on the wall and they're definitely at street level. So all you can see is, you know, this big brick wall and then these three small windows and then just the wheels of cars passing by or people on feet. All you can see are their shoes. And then there is Claire sitting on one end of the room opposite of the therapist. And it's a little bit of a darker room. And it just seems like symbolism for the title of the movie, What Lies Beneath, because it's a therapist's office. They're trying to dig and find what lies beneath the surface of Claire. And there are things that she's not remembering from this car accident she was in just a year ago that Norman does not want her to find out. So I found this, the fact that she goes to a therapist, interesting because she says that it was Norman's idea and he pushed her to go. But at the same time, we're going to find out that there's a lot of things that he's trying to make sure that she doesn't remember. And because there's things he's trying to make sure she doesn't remember, that's why he will get immediately defensive and shut her down, make her feel like she is crazy. He's good at telling a lie. So this therapist session, it's going decently well. She's not really giving up too much information. She's kind of just blaming these current occurrences on empty nest syndrome. Listen, I'm not an expert in that, so I can't say whether empty nest syndrome is the correct term for that or not. But I mean, it's definitely a transition in life, and some people may handle that differently or not as well as others. So it's a legitimate thing, but I almost feel like she's kind of grasping at it as a reason for what's happening to her, especially when Norman is being super fucking dismissive as fuck. So she does end up telling the therapist, my house is haunted. And his advice is to try to contact the ghost and see what it wants. And I honestly can't tell if he's being super for real here or if he thinks that this ghost isn't real and he's just trying to get her to find a way to connect with her inner self and understand her emotions more. So maybe that's it. But she says, how am I supposed to do that? Get a Ouija board? And that's what she does. Claire gets a Ouija board. Okay, guys, everyone, listen up. I don't care if you don't believe in the supernatural. Don't fuck with the Ouija boards. Okay. She goes to Kmart. I love that she goes to Kmart and gets a Ouija board. When she does the little seance thing, she does her not seance, sorry. Is that what that's called? A seance? That might actually be correct. I'm so sorry. I don't know. But when she does her little Ouija board sesh, she has Jody come over and they're in the bathroom because that's where she's been having the majority of these experiences and where she saw the face in the tub. And Jody's like,
are we hoping the ghost is going to have to use the potty?
This is where she was. This is where I saw her.
Oh, that makes sense. Where'd you finally find one?
Kmart.
You know, I think we're supposed to sit in a protective circle or something, aren't we? What's that for? Where'd you get it?
Never mind.
You stole the dead woman's shoe.
You have to have something of the dead woman's.
Says who? Is that blood on it?
I don't know. Just place your fingers on the message indicator.
Okay.
She's having a hard time taking it seriously, which I do appreciate Jody's levity in this situation, because it does get a little freaky. The planchette, it does actually move. You see it jerk around a little bit and their hands are not on it. And the candle that they have lit starts to flicker and diminish. And then the bathroom door from the hallway starts to creak open and it's like, and they're like, as the hallway door to the bathroom is opening and they're terrified, the door from their bedroom bangs open and it slams into Claire and it's just Cooper.
Thank you.
it brings the levity to the situation that they need. Because Cooper's just like, hey guys, what's up? Can I help you? Can I do this Ouija thing with you? All right. It's so cute. After Jody leaves, Claire goes back inside and she goes upstairs. And as she's walking up the stairs, she sees the steam coming out from under the bathroom door again. And it's like curling out the sides of the door frame. And she's visibly terrified and shaking. And she goes in there and the tub is full of water again, just perfectly to the brim. You see this quick flash of the ghost that's haunting her in the bathroom mirror that is quickly filling up with fog and condensation. She walks to the tub and you get another quick glimpse of the ghost in the water. I'm not even sure if Claire sees it. And she's so shaken and terrified. But at the same time, she's still like, this is my moment. And she turns around away from the tub and she's looking around the bathroom and she's like,
what do you want?
Then in the mirror, you start to see the words you know show up in the condensation. Claire freaks and she heads to Norman's work again. She is so upset. And this bitch, Norman, he's essentially like, why are you doing this to me?
You have a sentence. Are you angry with me?
What?
Maybe you resent how busy I've been.
No.
You know what I've got at stake with this paper. You know how important this is to me. I can't help but feel that somehow you're trying to sabotage me. You're trying to hurt me somehow.
Norman, this isn't about you. Something is happening to me. And it's not to get even, or and it's not some warped bid for attention. Something is happening in our house, whether you like it or not.
Are you mad that I've been working so much? Have I not been giving you enough attention? And she's like, motherfucker, this ain't about you. Something's in our house. Something is happening to me. Please take me seriously. She gets mad that he's being so dismissive. So she walks away. She starts to exit, go to the parking lot. He follows her. And as they're having this interaction, she sees in, it's like this sort of breezeway. It's enclosed, but it's all glass walls and stuff. There's a ton of people walking. It's also the middle of the night. So I'm like, what are all these academic people, whatever your titles are, doing in the middle of the night, just shuffling down this hallway? Because there's so many people, it's full. But it seems to be late. She sees Warren Fuhrer. The thing is, at this point, she thinks that this ghost, the person haunting her, is her neighbor, Mary. And she hasn't seen Mary since the fence thing. And she's also found that shoe with the blood drop on it on the porch, which she went and got off the porch and brought to the Ouija sesh. Mary's not dead. It's not Mary. But Claire goes in there and she confronts Warren as Norman's chasing after her, trying to get her to stop. She's yelling.
You think you're smart, don't you? You think you got away with it? Well, I know you killed her, you murdering son of a bitch!
Who?
Don't give me that shit! Your wife!
I didn't kill my wife. Are you all right?
And then Mary walks up next to Warren from out of the crowd, and she's like, I'm not dead. And he goes, my wife's not dead. And Claire is fucking shook. So now we're back at the therapist's office. He's trying to get more depth out of Claire, who's still very much like, I have a great life. You know, I'm just having an empty nest episode. My husband is great. My marriage is great. She was convinced that it was Mary because in one of the little hauntings of the house, the same night of the seance, I forgot this bit, when she ran downstairs out of the bathroom, that computer screen where she had been playing solitaire was lit up. Solitaire was pulled up. This text box was up. It was called the Winner Circle. And it was like, type in your initials or type in your name. The initials, M-E-F, were just being typed over and over and over and over and over again. And so she was even further convinced that this is Mary. So now she's like, who the fuck is M-E-F? She goes to this work dinner party thing with Norman. And as they're walking in, he's saying, don't get caught with Lois Templeton. She'll talk your ear off. And this is a very intentional thing that he's saying because the Templetons, they're part of the academic community that they're in and that he works for. And they're very important people to his job and the funding for his research and stuff like that. So he's got to show face at this party. He doesn't even want to go, but he's like, I got to go. The Templetons, they're the ones that had thrown the celebratory party a year ago for Norman when he won that DuPont chair thing. And it was at that party that Claire had seen something that shook her so much that she left abruptly. But she had forgotten completely about being upset at the parties. Later that night when they get home, that frame, the newspaper clipping frame, it falls again. And this time the back of the frame completely comes off. And on the back of this newspaper clipping at the bottom right-hand corner, the full article is cut off, but it's about a missing woman. And the full article is cut off, so you only see part of the name, but it's Mary Elizabeth, Elizabeth being her middle name. So then she gets on the good old clunk machine computer. You hear the dial-up tone. It's fantastic. And the loading sound that web pages used to make, that kind of ticking, loading, pixelating sound, it's very nostalgic. And she starts searching for missing people in Vermont, and she finds Madison Elizabeth Frank. And when the picture populates after its whole, like, thing, this woman is the ghost she's been seeing, and she also looks a lot like Claire. Okay, Madison Elizabeth Frank. She is a former student of Norman. Norman was having a fucking affair with her. She starts to do some more research on Madison and her disappearance. She ends up confronting Norman the next day with the missing poster. And again, he gets super aggro-aggressive because he's like, I see where this is going. Now you think this is the person haunting us. And at this point, he still doesn't believe that there's a haunting happening. He thinks that Claire's making it up to get his attention. But this time, she's very persistent in saying, I know it's her. And doesn't really let him make her second guess herself. Actually, as much as she's struggling in this moment, I actually get kind of proud of her because I'm like, oh, look at her. She's not letting him take away her reality and replace it with what he wants her to believe so he can go on living his perfect life without his secrets coming out into the open. Claire, she ends up going to Madison's mom's house. And this whole interaction is also honestly just fucking sad. At one point, Madison's mom is like,
why are you here?
And Claire just like,
I don't know.
And you can tell that Madison's mom is just so devastated and sad, and she has no one else. She's just in this little house in Vermont alone with her cat. I don't want to cry thinking about it because she's just so alone and lost, and she doesn't know what happened to her daughter. And Claire thinks she's being haunted by her daughter, and she doesn't know why yet at this point. She ends up going in Madison's room, and she sees this little lock of hair. It looks like, you know, maybe from a first haircut. It's this little lock of hair that's been tied into a braid and has this pink ribbon at the bottom of it. She takes it. She has also been gifted recently by her good old friend Jody, her best friend, this book on witchcraft, Ghosts and Alchemy, I believe is what it's titled. Witchcraft, Ghosts and Alchemy, something like that. So she takes this lock of hair, and now she's going to become possessed by fucking Madison. And this whole scene where she's possessed by Madison later that night when Norman comes home, this is where I'm like, Michelle Pfeiffer is brilliant in this fucking movie because she's playing two different characters and possessed at the same time. There's so much psychologically happening for her. She's creepy. She terrifies me. I really feel like Michelle Pfeiffer was born to play creepy because my God, does she do it well. Essentially, this whole scene plays out where she is possessed by the ghost of Madison. You even see her eyes turn green. It's this whole moment. And she's interacting with Norman as if she is Madison. I mean, it's not super clear at first, and he seems just as confused as the viewer. And becomes more and more alarmed as this interaction goes on. And at one point, he is on top of his desk and she's straddling him. And she's got Madison's hair is locked in her hand. And he becomes so freaked out by the things that she's saying that he throws her off.
I think she's starting to suspect something.
And when she's thrown off of him, that's when she kind of snaps out of this possession, and it's Claire again. And Claire says, you know, but she's repeating what she read on the mirror. And then she says, I know. And the whole thing comes out.
You know.
What the hell are you doing?
I know. I was there. Before the accident. Oh, I remember now.
What?
I came to the door. in the mirror.
Norman's trying to save face here. He's really just doing everything he can to deflect blame off of himself and try to emote enough sympathy out of Claire to get her to forgive him and move on almost instantly. And Claire is rightfully pissed, and she doesn't let him talk her out of her feelings. So she leaves and goes to Jody's. And this is where we also learn that Jody had seen fucking Norman in this little small town called Adamant. She had seen him with a blonde woman that at first she thought was Claire, but then realized it wasn't Claire. And she was going to go over and say something, but the closer she got, she could tell that they were having some sort of heated argument. And she just felt like something wasn't right and she shouldn't go over there. So she didn't. And then Claire got in the car accident, and Norman, he convinced Jody that telling Claire was not the move, the wrong thing to do. She was too fragile. She couldn't handle it, and to just let it go. And then she did for a year. Claire has been through so many fucking things, and this is not even over. The next morning, Claire goes back to the house. This scene, I instantly knew, oh, he's faking it. This fucker, Norman, he stages a fake accident. The power had gone out. He's in the tub. The shower head's on. The hair dryer's in the tub. Honestly, my first thought was that he was trying to stage a fake suicide attempt, which I don't take suicide lightly. And to stage a fake suicide attempt when suicide and suicidal ideation is a very real scary thing that people struggle with, the thought of him potentially staging a fake suicide was so invalidating to that experience and the struggle that people have, including myself at times, with suicide, enrages me. But it does turn out that he faked an accident. This motherfucker faked an accident to take the heat off of what he had actually done. This is his attempt to take the heat off what he actually did and gain empathy from Claire to distract from his actions and the fact that he had an affair and then the woman went missing and then more shit happened. Norman, he is trying to gain enough sympathy for himself from Claire to not only distract from what he's done, but to make sure she doesn't leave him. It's a manipulation and it's sick. And he does admit this, so I'm not even making this up. He will admit this pretty soon here. She does end up asking him, did you have anything to do with Madison's disappearance? This bitch.
Did you have anything to do with her disappearance?
Yes, I had an affair with her. And when I tried to break it off, she became unstable. She came out here to the house. She threatened to kill herself. Or you. I didn't think she'd go through with any of it. Then she disappeared.
Oh my God. He puts on such a good show. He really does. He starts to explain a half story of what happened. He doesn't tell the whole truth here. This is not what happened. He's trying to play it off like he is being open and honest, but also didn't have anything to do with it. Her disappearance, which is a lie. It's a lie. Norman, he makes this big show of an apology to her. He says, if you give me the chance, I'll spend the rest of my life making it up to you. And she doesn't actually say anything in response to this big old kind of grand apology that he tried to give to her. But she does kind of lean into the embrace that he's trying to give her, a sort of acceptance of his apology. And then they just kind of start to act like everything has gone back to normal. Her eyes in this moment are saying, I don't trust you, but she's kind of, I don't know, it's this very sad acceptance of what else do I do? She's still questioning her reality. She's still very confused by this whole thing. She does think that Madison's ghost tried to kill him. He does discover that she stole that lock of hair from Madison's house and he burns it, and they start to very briefly act like everything's fine. They go sailing. They talk about making plans to go on this little weekend trip to look for antiques. And that's when Claire suggests, and I know that it's still in her mind because of this and she's not given up on what's happening, because she suggests going to that little town, Adamant, that Jody had seen him in with Madison. She's like, I've never been there, but I've heard that it's this cute little, you know, blah, blah, blah town. And he's like, sounds great. Let's go. And they do go. And right before they go, she finds that weird ass little key again. And that weird ass little key belongs to this little jewelry shop that she sees upon arriving in Adamant. And they specialize in these chests that the key goes to, these big jewelry boxes, and this heart necklace that she's seen Madison wearing in pictures. And it's clear, oh, he was buying gifts for her. And that's where this key came from. And because she was also possessed by Madison in one of her little possessions, she straight up dives, like it ain't no big thing at all, into the lake off their dock and just does this like propel straight dive like it's nothing down to the bottom, straight to the bottom where this chest is, like it's nothing. And she just knows. So I'm like, nah, this is a possessed dive. This must be a possessed dive. After they go on this weekend trip, she's going to take another little midnight dive, and she retrieves the box, and the necklace was inside of it. And she's so startled by this, she goes to get the phone, but something kind of stops her, and she starts to walk back to where she left the chest, this jewelry box. And there's Norman, and he starts to tell her the truth, but it's still an untruth. He says,
you killed her, didn't you?
I did not. I didn't kill her. Jesus, Claire, listen to me. When I got here, she was already dead. She killed herself here in our house to destroy me.
Do you think that I'm stupid?
She left that for you in the garden with a letter. I burned the letter and I threw the box in the lake. A week before, she showed up at the DuPont party. I was terrified. She insisted, so I agreed to meet her here. When I got here, she'd taken pills. I tried to revive her, but she was gone. There was nothing I could do. So I put her in her car, and I drove to the boat ramp. I rolled it out into the lake. I made a terrible mistake, I know that. But tell me, Claire. Tell me, what should I have done? Should I sacrifice everything? Our marriage, my work, which I spent my whole life on.
So he's kind of saying she killed herself, and that he put her body in her car and rolled the car into the lake off a boat launch ramp nearby, and then threw the box in the lake, the jewelry box, and burned the letter. He gets on his knees in front of her, and he's like, what was I supposed to do? Other than apparently put her body in the car and drive her off the boat launch nearby. He's wording himself very much in a way to try to deflect all blame yet again. I don't believe him. He's still lying. He straight up fucking killed her. So what happened, what really happened, was he used that drug that his research team has been working on as a way to incapacitate Madison enough so he could get her in the tub upstairs, and he drowned her. He held her under that water and drowned her. And
I have no idea what it was like holding her underwater. Watch your life slip away. She gave me no choice.
That is why Claire continues to see Madison in that fucking tub. That's why there's so much activity in that bathroom. And then he's on his knees, and she's like, what are you asking me to do? And he's saying, I'm asking you to forgive me. But what he's really saying is, I want you to forget about this and not tell anyone. I was going to lose everything, everything I've worked for my whole life. You, my work, my research. Bitch, you did that the moment that you had an affair. Okay? She says in a really creepy, eerily way, but I love it.
That girl must be brought up.
And that's all she says is she hands the phone to him, wanting him to be the one to own up to his actions. You know? He makes a fake 911 call. He makes a fake 911 call. He doesn't actually call 911, but for a moment she thinks he does. He goes upstairs saying, you know, I'm gonna go change or something. And she does follow him up, but before she did that, she puts on Madison's necklace. I don't know why, but she does. I wonder if there was still like a partial possession thing here, because Madison, this whole time she's been haunting the fuck out of Claire, right? But really, Madison has been haunting the fuck out of her because she wants Claire to know the truth, and she wants Norman to pay for what he's done. But she's also doing this to protect Claire. Okay, so Madison, from her watery grave, even though she's been scaring the shit out of Claire, she's protecting her at the same time. Norman, he puts a cloth full of that paralytic drug thing in Claire's face, and he gets her in the tub. And this is where he's just fully his terrible self, his terrible murdery self. And this is where he starts almost kind of cracking jokes about his fake accident and how cold it was laying there waiting to be found. Fuck this guy. Fuck him. I hate him. And then he starts telling Claire how everyone will think that she was just so depressed and she couldn't handle her only daughter leaving for college and the car accident, and she's being haunted and she's paralyzed from these drugs, but you can see the fear in her eyes, and her heart is still beating really fast in her chest. And so you can see her heaving so much as the water is filling up slowly in this tub, and she knows she's about to drown. As this whole thing is happening, he's setting it up. He makes a phone call to Jody and leaves a message saying that him and Claire got into a big brawl and he's going to go sleep at the lab for the night. And could Jody check on Claire in the morning? He doesn't care that he's essentially, Claire lives, by the way. But if this was to play out his way, he doesn't give two shits that he's setting Jody up to come find her best friend's dead body. That's fucked. As this whole thing is happening, he notices there's a chain around Claire's neck that hadn't been there before. So he pulls her up a little bit to see what it is, because the necklace has slipped behind her. And as her body tips back again, it's Madison, her dead, drowned, blue, bloated ghost face. And it scares the fucking shit out of him, so much so that he drops Claire, water splashes everywhere. So then at the same time he slips in water, he slips and hits his head on the edge of this porcelain sink real hard. He hits his head so hard, and I'm like, fuck yes, Madison, coming in hard, helping Claire. Because he's trying to do the same thing to Claire that he did to Madison. It's insane. Claire does make it out of the tub, okay? Because remember, this paralytic anesthesia drug thing, it needs to be continuously administered for it to continue to work. So it does start to wear off. She does manage to get out of the tub. We get this whole scene of where's Norman, because when she gets out of the tub, he's not there. She tries to go call 911 on the phone in their bedroom. The thing is, he has their cordless phone in his pocket. It's on, so she's just getting a dial tone. She can't call out, so she's got to go find this cordless phone. She doesn't know where he is. She's fucking terrified. She ends up finding him at the bottom of the stairs. He's face flat, and this is where we start to get some of the really cool Hitchcock-like camera angles as this whole last scenes of the movie play out. She's trying to get the cordless phone out of his pocket, but his hand twitches, and then she goes flying backwards into this sort of side table that has his cell phone on its charging block on it and this little plate of keys, and the keys all go flying. It was a few different sets of keys. She frantically grabs at a set of keys, his cell phone. She abandons trying to call the police from their house. It's not working out anyway. And as she's rushing out the door, the camera slides up from under his body and meets his face, and you see his eyes flash open, and you're like, ah! And as she's trying to get into the car, her car that she has the wrong keys for, she's got the truck keys, which still has their boat hooked up to it. You get all of these different camera angles and visuals of her swinging the car door open, the side mirror, catching a glimpse of one of the windows where there's a lamp on, and you just see this shadow of him standing up from the floor. When she's driving away in the truck, there's this glimpse of one of the chairs on their porch having just been knocked into, so it's swinging back and forth, but you don't see a person. And then as she's driving away, that camera angle kind of like flies under from the grill of the truck and then under the truck and under the boat. And you just see a shoe drop out from the now loose canvas that was covering this boat. It's a little sailboat, right? The way the camera angles come in all Hitchcock-like throughout these next scenes, it just gets me so much. The intensity it builds, and you're not sure where he's going to come from, but you know he's there, and she doesn't know he's there. She has his cell phone, but she's on this old bridge that she's got to cross to, you know, leave from where their house is, and she's not going to get cell service until they're about halfway through this bridge. When she does get cell service, for some reason she stops the car, which I don't really quite understand. But she's also noticing at the same time that the canvas that was covering the boat is now loose. So she's like, oh shit, I think he got into the boat. He did, because now he's going to smash the back of the truck window open. So she starts to drive off again. She has at least dialed 911, but he's attacking her, so she's not able to communicate, but she's trying. They end up swerving, driving off the bridge at the end of it into a bunch of foliage and trees and such. They actually end up at the boat launch part of it and just go careening right into the water. They're in the water. He'd been attacking her. His foot kind of gets stuck in between the floor and like the door jamb of the passenger door or something like that. She's trying to get out, but the window won't roll down all the way. She tries to get out the back window that he smashed open, and he grabs her, and essentially he's like, I'm gonna finish my mission. And he tries to, I mean, the car is sinks, it's filling with water, but he still pushes her head under the water. And I'm like, this fucking maniac, y'all are about to drown anyway. All you gotta do is hang on to her. She's nothing but a leaf, and you're Harrison fucking Ford. The great thing about this part is he rolled Madison's car off the same boat ramp that they went off of. So Madison is in down there in her watery grave, and she's like, excellent. Excellent. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for coming to this place in time. So I could come in clutch yet again to make sure that Claire gets away. Madison's ghost body comes up out of her car, which I know sounds ridiculous, but it's actually done pretty well. She holds him underwater and Claire gets out. And even though Madison did die, she kind of wins in this moment. He's dead. The monster's dead. The very last scene of this movie is this great snowy, again, very Hitchcock-like scene in a graveyard. And it's the snow, the whiteness is so stark against the grays and blacks of the headstones and the dead trees. And there's Claire in all black. She's got one single red rose in her hand and she's at a gravestone. And then you see that it's Madison's grave. And she leaves the rose at Madison's grave, and that's how it ends. Y'all, I fucking love this movie. It's so good. Please go watch it if you can. I bought it on DVD. I don't know. I should have checked. If I can find anywhere to stream it for free, I will link it in the show notes, but I don't know off the top of my head at this second. I should have checked. I'm sorry. I think this is a fantastic movie. It's so much fun. There's something about watching this kind of thriller in summer that just does it for me. And I don't even know how to explain that, but there's just certain movies that hit better in summertime. And this is one of those movies that I'm like, this is such a good summertime thriller. It doesn't take place in summer. Anyways, I enjoyed this film so much. Even though Harrison Ford gives me the icks, I really think it's more just the character, and I'm not being totally fair in that feeling. But, you know, I guess he played his role real well, because I definitely hated him and everything he did and said with the end of this movie. He was a major dick bag. Okay, so Mr. Ford, good job. Michelle Pfeiffer stole the show for me. She truly did. Before I did my notes for this episode, I actually watched this movie with my best friend, and she had never seen it. This movie, it really does creep me out. It is kind of one of those movies that as I'm watching it, I'm like, ooh, how am I gonna feel after this? Am I gonna, you know, think I'm being haunted tonight as I try to sleep? It's one of those, and I enjoyed it. Thanks for listening. I really feel like I kind of just totally veered off from my whole intent of the Millennial Rewatcher and talking about some heavier things. I mean, this is revisiting a movie from my past that I loved and remember holding in high regard. And I had not seen this in such a long time. It was such a treat to revisit. That's the part about doing this that I really love, is while sometimes the movies I'm revisiting can be really heavy for my brain space and for me to emotionally understand why I have these intense bonds with, getting to rewatch movies like this where I loved it a lot but don't really have a trauma bond necessarily to it is just a lot of fun. And it's still fun to rewatch things that I loved when I was much younger with my adult eye and the new understandings I have about myself. I get to enjoy it all over again, and that's fun. Thanks for listening, guys. I promise my next episode will be out on time. I think I might do a Disney original again. That or a Drop Dead Gorgeous, because I really do want to do that. I just want to do that episode right, because there's just a lot of pieces that I want to discuss and discuss properly. We'll see. Don't forget to give the show a follow so you can get an alert when my next episode is out.
Okay, bye.
Bye.